Main speaker tonight is Sandy D.
Hi, my name is Sandy and I'm an alcoholic. First of all, I want to thank Lindsay for asking me to come down here and participate tonight. I love this group. This group has been a part of my life for many, many years. And I also want to thank one of the most important men in my life, and that's my sponsor, Harvey. He's also been a major part of my life since I got sober. My untreated Al-Anon Don is here. And then a young gentleman named David that helps me look beautiful every week. And I love him a lot, too. This group means so much to me. I took my first birthday cake here on February 22nd, 1986. And every year after that, until I had my 8th birthday, I took my cake here. And I always lived in fear of doing one thing, is when I came up these stairs that I was going to fall. I have such an incredible fear of heights. And there's something so intimidating about these stairs, and I don't know what it is, but I was bound and determined I was just going to bolt up here tonight and not, you know, even look at them. So that's really an accomplishment for me. As I said, my sobriety date's February 22nd, 1986. I've been sober just a little over 11 years. And Alcoholics Anonymous is nothing new to me. I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1972. The other thing I do is I give my, the day I was born, I always give that when I go out and talk. There's a reason for that, too. My other birthday is July 27th, 1942, and I'll be 55 in just a couple of weeks and still alive. And to me, that's, you know, quite an accomplishment. And I feel better at the age of 55 than I ever did, and I do not have a problem with my age, you know. And when I finally did get sober, I was 43. And like I said, it was 1972 when I started on this journey in AA. And, you know, I didn't just come in here and go out and stay gone for a couple of years and come back. I stayed here all those years, and I drank in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't get sober until 1986. And, you know, it's true what they say. You will hear when we're meant to hear. And for me, you know, I just fought this thing with all my might for a lot of years. And only through an inventory and the fact that I was able to turn my life and my will over to a sponsor that, you know, I had a lot of respect for, and I watched what he did in our home group, and I was interested in his way of life. And I used to kid about his little pickup truck having 186,000 miles on it, pure AA miles. And thank God for Harvey, because if it hadn't been for him in 1986, I probably wouldn't be here today, because I was so totally afraid of him and so full of fear, and I didn't realize until a long time later that his actions came from his sponsor. And that's the way this program works. You know, it's handed down from sponsor to baby to sponsor to baby. And that's what makes this thing work when nothing else in the world, you know, will work. Alcoholics Anonymous will work. I come from an alcoholic background. I come from a violent alcoholic family. I come from below poverty level. My father was a full-blown alcoholic, I think, by the time he was 13. My mother was the same way. I come from a very, I mean this in the true sense of the word, a very ignorant background. Most of my family came out of the, you know, the Black Hills and West Virginia, and the highest they ever went was like third and fourth grade in school. I'm one of two people in my whole family that ever graduated from high school. And I never knew what a family life was. I felt from the very beginning, when I was old enough to walk, that my case was totally different. I had my first ride in a black and white patrol car at the age of 3. I was picked up on a rainy night, late at night, in the streets in Pomona while my mom and dad were in a bar drinking. Made my first trip to juvenile hall when I was 3 years of age, and that's the way it was until I grew up. I lived in 27 foster homes all my life. They would move us about every 6 months, you know, during that time, because they didn't want us to be, you know, attached. And I lived in a lot of work homes and spent much of my time as I got older in juvenile hall in L.A. and then later in McLaren Hall in El Monte. So I didn't believe that there was a God. I didn't realize until I got to this program that I was an atheist, and that was one of the reasons why I couldn't get sober all those years, because I felt that if there was a hell, that this was it, and I was living in it. I lived in some very extremely abusive homes, and from time to time when they would try to move me back home, and my mother and dad would get sober briefly and try to maintain that home, it wouldn't last any more than 6 weeks. And my father was a butcher by trade, and when they did get drunk, they liked to use these butcher knives on each other. And one night my father mistaken me for my mother, and I have 132 stitches on me from where I was cut up very badly. So much of it was like a Friday the 13th life for me. And I wasn't to know any of this till much later in life when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was very fortunate early in my teens. I married into a very wealthy family, and I do believe today that there are guardian angels, and I believe that I had one even though I denied there was a God. That worked well for me. It didn't work so well for him. And he married me and came from the right side of the tracks, and I came from the other side of the tracks. And we were married for about 7 or 8 years before he finally decided that marriage wasn't going to work. I was in and out of psychiatrist's office just one after another trying to find out what was wrong with me. And all during this time, though, I didn't believe in alcohol. I swore that I'd never have alcohol in the house. I swore that it would never be part of my life, because it had deprived me of all of the things that you had, you know, the Christmases and the birthdays and the brothers and the sisters. And I had a half-brother that I wasn't to know till later on in life. I'm a sole survivor today. I have one son that's 32, and he's full-blown in this disease. And all I can do is release him of love and let him know that there is a place. If someday he wants to come, he can come and join me. And but he's doing the same thing I did, and I know that I'm powerless over that. And he's just out there doing his thing. When that marriage went by the wayside, and my mother by this time had committed suicide, she had checked herself into a motel in Pomona and drank taken a case of Seagram's and literally killed herself. And she died in Patton State Hospital with tubes coming out of her body, and she was bleeding profusely and screaming. She went out of this life screaming and hollering, and I think that that was my first impression that I never wanted to be like that. I never wanted to go out like she did. And then a few months later, my father died of a hideous cancer death in City of Hope. I was told that he was sober the last 10 years in this program, but I didn't know my mother and dad hardly at all. I didn't know them very well at all. It took me a long time to realize that I was a woman with a lot of rage and a lot of anger in her. And, you know, I still have that rage and that anger today. But it becomes a little easier as, you know, time goes by and I do what I'm supposed to do here. But some things don't, you know, they just don't get better overnight. And that's one of them with me, is I get very angry and I have a bad temper, and sometimes I say things that I'm sorry for. And I find it very hard to say, you know, to apologize or make amends that we learn to do here. But I know that if I don't make these amends, that I'm the one that ultimately will suffer for it. So in 1972, I was in a very abusive marriage. And I was married to a man that loved to beat me and put me in the hospital and left me for dead several times. And I went from having a lot of money in the first marriage to nothing in the second marriage. I went through a lot of marriages. I've been in jail. I've been in hospitals. I've had 502s. I've done all of those things that we do when we're out there defending the right to drink. And it isn't the alcohol, it's them. You know, I blamed everything on everyone else, and I never stood accountable. I never stood accountable for anything in my life until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I learned that by standing accountable is acceptance, and acceptance is release and surrender. And we learn about ourselves, and some of the things we learn we don't like, but that's where we work through them, and that's what sponsors are for. I went up to 280 pounds, and I had black hair. One cascade was good, two was better. And I wore muumuus, and I had a Ford LTD that looked like a 1949 Studebaker in the front, because I'd hit more poles with it that San Dimas Sheriff's Department would see me coming down the street, man, and they knew who I was. It was held together with hair clips, and the body was sprung on it. And if you can imagine, 280 pounds crawling in and out the windows of the car because the doors won't open. I mean, it was just absolutely bizarre. I was a sight to behold, and I was commonly referred to in the city of Azusa as a crazy lady from Azusa. That's exactly what I was. And I was one of those women that used to get drunk and get up on top of the roof of her house and throw eggs at the guy's truck next door because they wouldn't let my son play with their kids because my four-year-old loved to use the four-letter word. I couldn't understand that. And I don't think any of the neighbors had television sets in that neighborhood through those years because, you know, we were just a show all in itself. I mean, the police department just lived at my house. I mean, it was incredible. They came in one night and threatened to arrest me in my own house, and I told them they couldn't do that, and they did. But I did all these crazy things, you know, that we do, and I never learned how to cook. I never learned how to be a mother. I never learned how to do any of the things that seemingly all of you could do, and I just knew that I was different. But behind alcohol, I could do this. And it was during a period of time during Vietnam that we were just, I like to call it going through the eye of the hurricane of the Vietnam situation, when I was married to this first husband that got drafted in the Army because he'd taken a college deferment. Now, I graduated from high school, and I went on to junior college, and I went on to college, but I made straight D minuses, and when I got out of high school, I mean, that D minus was so shaky that I barely made it. In fact, to this day, I do believe my ex-father-in-law bribed my teacher in order for me to get that D minus. I could just never do grades in school. Nothing ever came easy for me when it came to school. I was never successful. I was one of these people that started things and never finished them. That was just the way that my life was. And I knew that I wouldn't see the age of 21 because, you know, I just knew that I didn't have a long life because of all of the things that I had been through. But when we got to Colorado Springs, when I was married to this first husband, and I wouldn't have alcohol in the house, and we would have all of these parties, and he was an officer, and he was General Dade in the Army, and I was expected to do certain things, and I couldn't function as a human being. And all my life, you know, when I had gone to the shows, I used to watch Marilyn Monroe on screen, and I used to swear that one day when I got older, I would never be hungry, I would never be barefooted, my hair would never be matted to my head, I would never be filthy dirty, and I would never wear the same dress for like 2 weeks at a time. I mean, I was just somebody that you didn't want your child to be within 10 feet of. I was just like a Raggedy Ann, and I was just filthy all the time because those are the type of homes and the conditions I lived in. But I swore that one day that I would be like her, and I would have the mink coats and the diamonds and the jewelry in the home, and that was my dream and my fantasy all of my life. When I did get into this first marriage and I had money to spend, I used to buy all of the clothes I could buy. I used to call them throwaways. I'd buy them once, wear them, and throw them away because nothing would fit, and I didn't feel comfortable in anything that I had. And I get my hair done 2, 3, 4 times a week, and it was just a constant change for me, trying to seek out an identity, and I just never had an identity. Then I found myself in a situation in the Army in Colorado Springs that I was at the officer's club, and I was expected to act like an officer's wife, and I didn't know how to do that, and I was introduced to alcohol during that time. And I want to tell you that from the very first drink that I picked up, I was alcoholic. I mean, it started just that quickly with me. I went from the very first day I took a drink at the officer's base, sitting on a bar stool in the club, looking in the mirror, trying to decide whether I looked like Sandra Dee or Marilyn Monroe, and deciding I didn't look like either. I had the blonde hair and the Sandra Dee look and the pink suit and the basket curls and the whole bit. But I just knew that one curl was more crooked than the other, and my lipstick was shaved off from my suit. And I kept looking in that mirror, sitting at that bar, and looking at this bartender, and he mixed me this drink, and I drank one drink. And I turned to the general's wife, and I said, "But you don't understand, I don't drink. Alcohol isn't part of my life." And she says, "You need to lighten up. You need to fit in. And if you want to see your husband get ahead in the Army, you need to learn to be part of the group." So she introduced me to a lady's drink. I remember picking up this drink and tasting it, and it didn't taste like alcohol. It tasted good. And I drank it, and instantly I started doing all of the things that many of us have done. I began to make excuses as to why my mother was an alcoholic and my father was an alcoholic, and why I wasn't an alcoholic. I had money, I had money, property, and prestige. I had everything in the world that I wanted. I knew how to drive a car. My mother never knew how to drive a car. I had an education. It was shaky, but I had one. My mother never went past the fourth grade of school. So for all of these reasons, I wasn't an alcoholic. I needed therapy. The second and the third drink that I sat there and I drank that day, you know, the world began to change in front of my eyes. And I was just barely over 21, I believe, at that time. I looked back in the mirror and I saw myself, and I saw myself as a whole person. My hair couldn't have been prettier than it was that day. My lipstick, my God, matched that jacket. Every song they played on the jukebox was made for me. The world absolutely came alive. I could touch my fingers and they felt warm. And it felt like I didn't have that hollowness inside of me that I felt all those years. And as Mike Clancy talks about, it's that big hollow hole in your gut. And it began to fill up and I began to feel warm. I began to feel part of, and I began to feel that I really belonged where I was. And alcohol wasn't my problem. Well, from that very day on, I drank daily. I drank daily. And that was in my early 20s. But I became a periodic drinker after a while because, you see, that husband left me because he thought I had mental and emotional problems. I came back to California and I went through all of these other things that I talked about. And that's all of the marriages and going to jail, going to hospitals. I lost 4 children through deaths, various deaths. And if that didn't convince me more than anything that there wasn't a God, that did. And then I wound up in 1972 in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And this husband that had badly abused me was a restaurant manager. And he was told that there was a place that he could take me if I never wanted to take another drink again. It was one of his chefs. And that place was Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only one good thing that man ever did for me, was he introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me down to the 502 Club in Covina, which was really quite small in those days and in the front. And I went into my first Sunday morning meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, dressed in a muumuu, my hair unkempt, black, 2 cascades, long black eyelashes, bloated and just profusely sweating, and a muumuu, and a pint here, and a pint here. And I was set and ready for AA. Well, it's true what they tell us. You know, you may not make it the first time, second time, the third time in this program, and you may make it the first time. You know, you just don't know. But one thing for sure I do believe in is from your first AA meeting on, one thing for sure you'll go away with is it'll screw up your drinking forever. And that's what it did for me. I went for 30 days, and then gradually I started backing away, and I didn't go anymore because I needed the alcohol worse than I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. And alcohol had done for me what nothing else had ever done before. It became my best friend. It allowed me to go places and do things like jail, hospitals, losing homes, husbands, having money to having no money, having money again to having no money, all these ups and downs, still defending my right to drink and not admitting or surrendering to the fact that alcoholism was my problem and living was my problem. But one of these years, as I was coming in and out, and I always managed to stay around the 502 Club, it was about 1984, and I was in my last marriage to my ex-husband that was working in aerospace, and he was building space launches for the space shuttles. And he wanted a drinking partner, so I had known him in high school, so I went along with him and we drank. Eventually we got together and he had custody of his 2 daughters. They were 11 and 12, and I had my son at the time who was about 9. We got married and moved in and bought this condo and tried to put together this Ozzie and Harriet way of life. Well, this didn't last very long, but I had to learn how to drink, lose weight, be normal, when he came home by 4:30 in the afternoon so we could go out and do what he calls some real drinking. So then I learned the world of amphetamines, and that was really good. I went from 200 and some pounds down to 130, and I said, this is really great. I can do this. I can handle this. So what happened was, is I wound up having the cleanest house in town. I was very thin. I had a lot of nice clothes. I had the new car back. I had the jewelry, and I was well on my way. This lasted for about 6 months, and he came home one day and said, same thing as all the other relationships had said in the past. This isn't working. I'm moving forward, and you're standing still, and you're holding me back from going on in my career. Because by this time, the aerospace had gone down, and he went to work for Walt Disney, and he went to work in the special effects department, and he was beginning to make a name for himself in Fox and the Hound and Tron and some of the other movies in those days. And I knew that he was going to be one of those that went away and left me just like all the others did. So I went right back to the only place that I knew to go, and that was Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back in 1985, and there was a little man there that had gray hair that sat in the attitude adjustment meeting at 6:15 in the morning that I went to every morning for a long, long time. I used to come in and sit down, and he would tell me to shut up and listen. They used to call on me to share, and he would tell them not to call on me. And I had made up my mind, if they didn't get rid of this man, he was going to destroy this thing called AA. Well, that man later became my sponsor, and he still is today. But I came in, and I decided that in order to save this relationship, that I'd better go to a meeting every day, and I'd better buy a big book, and I'd better get one of these things that they call sponsors. So I picked out a woman that I didn't have a lot of respect for. I didn't think she was as smart as I was. She certainly didn't have the money that I had. So I figured that this was safe. And I would call her once a month whether she needed it or not. So that's the way I did AA for 9 months. I managed to get, finally, the first time since 1972, now we're at 1985, I got 9 months together. At the end of that 9 months now, I was secretary in one of our AA meetings at the club. I was treasurer in another. I was going out doing 10-minute speaking periodically, and I was leading a lot of the meetings, and I felt that I was fast on my way to being Miss AA with 9 months of sobriety. Also, through the years, I had been lucky enough to have some part-time jobs working in little insurance offices and riding auto and homeowners and things like that in those days. And I had gone back to work because Walt Disney had moved to Florida, and my husband was not working during that time. So I went to work in the insurance industry. And I got a job with a franchise, and I started out in a health and life company, writing more fire and casualty insurance than any other franchise. But I was doing it on amphetamines and AA. Now, I wasn't drinking, so that was okay. And at that time, I thought it was perfectly safe to keep our little secrets. If they don't know I'm taking amphetamines, you know, no problem, as long as I don't drink. At the end of 9 months, I was going to a lot of meetings. I had a sponsor. I was making a lot of phone calls. I had the most perfect house in town. I had two of the most adorable long-haired dachshunds you ever saw. I was driving a new car. My kids were well-dressed. And my husband, by this time, was working for George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. And he was well on his way. And I was making good money. Now I'm 9 months sober. I wind up in a sales rally down at Dustrail Hills, and I'm called up in front of my peers, which is about 2,500 people at that time, and I received an award for riding more fire and casualty in 4 months' time than any other franchise in the business. Okay, now I'm 9 months sober. I have everything in the world that I want. I have that home back. I have the jewelry. I've got everything. Everything is in its place. All my I's are dotted and all my T's are crossed. I stood up there that night and I took a plaque for all my accomplishments, and I looked back and I said to myself, look what I've done. Look how far I've come. I have shown them I can do it all by myself. I walked out of that sales rally and I walked into a bar and I got drunk that night. And 3 days later, I didn't have that job anymore. And about 6 weeks later, the husband moved out, the kids were gone, and I had my two long-haired dachshunds in what used to be a beautiful condominium, and I had totally destroyed it. I had broken out all of the windows in this condo. I had ripped up the carpet, and I went on the worst drunk that I had been on. When I came out of that drunk, I came out of the drunk, and I still to this day believe that it was my mother was calling out to me. I tried to kill myself by putting Purex in a vodka bottle and vodka in a Purex bottle, and I bought a lot of Dramamine, and I bought a lot of Salminex, and bought a lot of the cross-the-counter stuff, and I went to bed. And somewhere along in the middle of the night, I heard my mother calling out to me, and she'd been dead for a long time. And my given name is Andrea, it's not Sandy, and I heard her calling Andrea. And I remember crawling out of this waterbed and crawling into the bathroom. I couldn't walk. I had been drinking for days, and I hadn't eaten. And I remember crawling down the stairs of this condominium, and it must have been real early in the wee hours of the morning. I couldn't stand up because I couldn't walk. And I crawled downstairs and I crawled into the kitchen and I was so dehydrated that I had to have something to drink. And I remember reaching up for that refrigerator and pulling out a bottle of Coors beer, turning around, and I was shaking so bad I couldn't take the cap off. So I hit it against the sink and I drank it with those two little dogs sitting there unconditionally loving me. and I still didn't know why I couldn't stop drinking. I stayed that way for about 24 hours, and I tried to call people in Alcoholics Anonymous, but nobody wanted to talk to me by this time, because I was known as the real loser, you know, coming in and out and doing all the things that I had done. So what I did was, is I got sober one more time, tried to put that house together, but it didn't happen. I became one of the first volunteers in the Anabuse program at the Baldwin Park Center, but that didn't work. We know that Anabuse isn't part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then I started asking myself all these questions as to why I couldn't make it. Why couldn't I be like you? Why couldn't I stay sober? Why couldn't I get this thing that they call Alcoholics Anonymous? And what did they mean by acceptance and surrender? Honesty. What did one day at a time mean? And I've been coming in and out since 1972, and I didn't have a clue. I had a big book that was just glued together with tomato juice from drinking vodka and tomato juice together. I couldn't even open up the pages. I had Bill seize it, and I'd never had it open. I thought all you had to do was buy it. I didn't know you had to read it. I mean, nobody ever told me that before. Of course, I wouldn't listen either. So finally, in 1986, when I hit my last drunk, I drove to Agora in a total blackout on Valentine's Day in a total downpour, and I drove clear back, and I don't remember how I got there, and I don't remember how I got home. I came back into that same condo that I had put back together again, and everybody one more time was gone. And this time, nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous was picking up their phones for me. Nobody would talk to me. I remember sobering up all by myself in that condo. And I stayed there for 2 days totally alone and so sick I couldn't even walk. I had gone from about 160 bloat pounds down to about 125 because I hadn't eaten, I had just drank. And what I did when I woke up on February 21st, and I crawled back down the stairs and got back up on that bar stool in my kitchen, and I looked around one more time at a home that I had dearly loved and always dreamed of having that I had totally destroyed. And I said, my God, what have I done? And until that time, at the age of 43, I had never used the word God in my life because I didn't believe there was a God. And I sat there and I said, my God, I'm going to die. I can't die and I can't live. I have absolutely no one in this world except my two little dogs. What am I going to do? And what I did that day was the beginning of surrendering for me, and I didn't even know. You know, sometimes I believe that if we know what's happening to us at the time it happens, that we may not do it because we're too intelligent for it. And if we just let it happen and we go with it, that in the end everything turns out right because we're turning our will and our life over to a God that we don't understand, and certainly one that I didn't understand. So what I did that day was I gathered two pair of Levi's together, and I don't know, I thought I was going to build a Noah's Ark, because I took two of everything. Two plates, two knives, two forks, two spoons, two pair of Levi's, and two shirts, and two purses, and two of everything. And I loaded it in my little car. I drove out the gates of that condo, and I didn't know that I was never to come back there again. I checked into a little efficiency apartment, and the next morning I wound back up in our 6:15 attitude adjustment meeting, and who was there? But the little gray-haired man from Covina. And I remember leaving that meeting that morning only with a different sense, a totally different sense of being. That one particular morning, I sit there and I began to listen to everything that you had to say. I began to listen and watch you, and watch as you left and got in your cars after the meeting and you went off to your jobs, home to take care of your children. And there I sat. And I began to be afraid of what was going to happen to me for the rest of the day, and where was I going to go, and what was I going to do, and how was I going to stay sober. So what I did was, I drove around and around the city limits of Covina, so totally terrified that my little car would turn into my most favorite liquor store, as it had always done. But instead, I wound up back down at our club, our 502 club, and I had my sponsor's telephone number with me, and to this day, I do not know who gave it to me. And I love to share this story, and especially when he's here, because this is probably the most important part of my talk that I love so much. And tell me there isn't a God. I sat in the club and I kept trying to call him and he didn't answer the phone that day. And then it was about noontime and I was beginning to wonder what I was going to do. So totally, and this time I wasn't afraid that there wouldn't be enough vodka. I was afraid that I would go buy the vodka, which is a real change for me. And I kept crying out to a God that I didn't understand. Oh my God, help me, don't let me go to the liquor store. And I didn't even realize what I was doing. About the time I was getting ready to get up and leave the club, somebody walked in behind me and put their hands on my shoulder, and I looked back and it was him. And I says, oh my God, where have you been? I've been trying to call you all morning, and you haven't been home. And he says, you know, honey, he says, the strange, and he never called me honey. He called me all kinds of stuff, but never honey. He says, I had gone home, I was working on an air conditioning job, and Brenda was going to fix me my lunch, and I was going to go back to work. He said, I had a strange feeling that I belonged and I needed to come to the club. He says, and I think I know why. He took me into our meeting room, and for the next 2.5 hours, he began to tell me things about Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd heard all these years, but didn't understand, because I wasn't willing. And he began to tell me all of the reasons why I drank and why I couldn't stay sober. And then he told me all the things that I'd have to do, and I would have to do, if I want in order to stay sober. After we got through talking, I looked at him and I said, you know, I don't think you suppose you would consider sponsoring somebody the likes of me, that's been where I've been and done what I've done, and never been able to stay sober. He says, well, what do you think we've been doing for the last 2.5 hours? So he agreed to sponsor me, but the conditions were incredible, and I didn't think I could do it. He says, I'll sponsor you on these conditions. One, you don't say, I want, I will, I think. You don't think at all. I'll do the thinking for you. You'll call me every night at 6 o'clock. You'll go to these meetings, and if I tell you you'll drive a speaker to a meeting, you'll do it. You won't even pick up an ashtray in a meeting unless I tell you you can do it. If you can do all of these things, then maybe it'll work. But if not, I can't sponsor you. I walked out of there so totally full of fear, because I'd had a lot of probation officers growing up, and I thought, my God, I'm 43 years old, and I got a probation officer, for crying out loud. But you know, I was so totally terrified and so full of fear that I would head for that liquor store that I was willing to do and go to any lengths that it took in order to stay sober. I began to do everything that he told me to do, and I still do to this day. I have all the love and respect and admiration for my sponsor as much as I did February 22nd, 1986. No matter when my phone rings today, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. If he has something he wants me to do, I do it. Because you see, I didn't know what respect was before. And I'm not about to turn on the very thing that's given me a life. These last 11 years have been absolutely wonderful for me. A lot of pain, but a lot of good things have happened to me too. One of them is that husband that worked in the movie industry, I stayed very much a part of his life all these years. Because I have a handicapped daughter that's had 2 major brain surgeries. And I've remained very much a part of her life too. He was diagnosed with terminal cancer in February, and he didn't know he was sick. And he's been given 3 months to live. Well, he's still alive today, but at least I'm there to be able to take care of him and my daughter and go on. If I hadn't gotten sober and came to you, I wouldn't be able to do this today. God had a plan for me. And if I had gotten in the way, I might not be standing up here before you tonight. I've been able to work in an insurance industry, something that I never thought I'd be able to do. I've gone on and been able to work with some of the biggest entertainment in this state. Recently, though, I developed a heart condition, and I've been put on disability. And I've had to stay home this last 6-7 months, and I thought I'd go crazy. But I haven't, because you see, I've been able to fill that time with babies and that I sponsor and the things I do in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the things, and I'll close with this, that I wanted to do very early in sobriety was I went to my first convention in San Diego when Sarah was chairman, and my sponsor was co-chairman. And I remember sitting in that convention with 6 months sobriety, and I said to somebody that belonged to our club, and I said, you know what? Do you suppose someday that I'll be able to be a hostess in this thing or serve coffee here? She says, honey, you stay sober and you do what you're supposed to do. Maybe one day you might be chairman. And that was something that was beyond my wildest imagination. Last year in San Diego, I was voted chairman in 1998. And that's been one of the most wonderful gifts that you have given me. You have given me. And if I would have to give up any one thing in my life today, the last thing in the world that I would give up would be my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, because without it, I have no life. It's made me the woman that I always dreamed of being almost years ago. I've been able to do a lot of the things in life that I thought I'd never be able to do. But you see, it's all been a direct gift from you. It's been a wonderful life, and it's been a wonderful journey. And I love this group, and I want to thank you for allowing me to be here tonight. Thank you.